even if we don't disintermediate, we can actually make the system much more productive, much less expensive. So we can streamline the financial systems and how the transactions are done today.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Mind Gravity Podcast. I'm your host, Rohan Handa. Guys, on today's show, we have a really special guest, Professor Mihaela Olieru. Professor Olieru is president of the Impact Institute for the Digital Economy, aiming to capitalize on her achievements as the Canada Research Chair in Adaptive Information Infrastructures for the eSociety, which she held for 5 years since July 2005. In 2006, she was appointed to the Science and Engineering Research Council of Singapore. And in 2010, she was appointed expert in ICT-enabled innovation at the Executive Authority for Scientific Research and Innovation of Romania, and as an adjunct research professor at Carleton University in Ottawa. She has led several large-scale projects funded by DRDC, NBIF, and many others targeting the management of complex situations through more organic ways of governance. She's the member of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Data-Driven Development, and she's been pioneering the effort of adoption and spreading information about blockchain and digital economy, including cryptocurrency, stablecoins, and every other aspect in between. So I'm extremely excited for our conversation. So without any further ado, let's tune in. All right, Dr. Mihaela, welcome to the Mind Gravity Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm quite enthusiastic about having a conversation with you. We've been planning this for some time.
I've been waiting to talk to you for a while, but I'm glad we're here today. And before we dive into, you know, specialized conversations for today's session, I would love to learn a bit more about your background and what you're currently working on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I can, you know, if I'm to coin it, what motivates me and what motivated me through in shaping my career path as well is can be summed up in the slogan, freedom from the hierarchy and from centralization. And this actually, you know, happened very organically. I studied robotics and automation, and I've done my PhD in intelligent manufacturing systems and automation. Actually, decentralizing manufacturing, counterproductive manufacturing plants like Daimler, Chrysler, and also, you know, going up the chain of the supply chain. Of course, that is very useful because then you can have many suppliers, be much more adaptive. You can do this planning and scheduling. If you receive an order which is unexpected, like now with the crisis, okay, I have to reorganize my production to produce masks or other things. Right. So this can be enabled with a centralized rigid system, you cannot. And then this, the same line of thinking came when 9/11 happened, when I was a professor in Canada and researching these distributed systems. And then I realized that the incident command system, which FEMA is using and which the Department of Defense, all these first responders are using, are also counterproductive. So then I applied my findings to that, and so-called SOS network, self-organizing security. So I decentralized the incident command system, making it more responsive, more adaptive. And of course, then Bitcoin came exactly when we ended up with an infrastructure called, you know, it was a consortium called the Foundation for Intelligent Physical Agents. But they were doing mainly software infrastructures, of course. And we ended up with, of course, pretty complex software architectures for these decentralized systems. But when Bitcoin came, we were so ready to embrace an elegant structure for the governance systems, and including, of course, the financial systems. So this is my backstory. You know, I think in a nutshell, of course, there's much more to it, yeah. But I ended up organically in this crypto blockchain world.
No, I think that's a fascinating journey. You've seen the ins and out of a lot of technically challenging problems throughout your career. And then came Bitcoin, as you just alluded to a few seconds ago. What was so attractive about cryptocurrency or Bitcoin sector that you were like, no, this is what I'm interested in?
Yeah, so no, first of all, the elegance with which you can actually do this peer-to-peer, you can implement these peer-to-peer systems, and especially the governance systems. Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin per se, of course, the freedom from the financial system. That's right. Definitely, probably, you know, everybody has seen that. But starting from there and being an artificial intelligence expert, of course, the next thing was, how do we liberate ourselves? How can we get free from the centralized platforms which are exploiting our data? Data is the new oil. And how can we actually give people and empower people with their data, just as we empower them with their finances through blockchain and Bitcoin? So these two things are, you know, I'm very passionate about using decentralized techniques to solve the data conundrum, and I am on the World Economic Forum data-driven development, of course, as well as new economic models that embed the values of people and work for the individual. And I'm advising some companies in this regard.
Got it. I think that's interesting. You point out, you know, how data is a new oil, and how the centralized companies are kind of exploiting the data the consumers provide them with. So just digging a few layers deeper, how does the cryptocurrencies kind of help eliminate that, apart from that peer-to-peer transaction? And Bitcoin came way back when in 2008, and it's 2020, but the mass adoption of cryptocurrencies as either a medium of exchange or an asset class has still been lukewarm. Just help us walk through what's happening behind the scenes.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, cryptocurrencies, of course, so money, currencies, cryptocurrencies. So cryptocurrencies, starting with Bitcoin, mm-hmm. are enablers of electronic cash transactions. Yeah, so Bitcoin was the first electronic cash system, and it enabled this direct peer-to-peer way of exchange. If we go back to, obviously, as what is money, what is currency, currencies are systems of value exchange. Problem is, and problem to be solved, is that the financial system betrayed us, it lost its legitimacy, and as such, the only way to step out of this system was to find a way to deliver cash electronically, peer-to-peer, because, you know, you cannot meet everyone with who you want to transact. As such, the need for cryptocurrencies, this enables. So cryptocurrencies are a type of digital asset, as you rightfully mentioned, which can be used to exchange value between parties and uses encryption to secure how it's transferred and how it controls the creation of new units of that currency.
Would it be fair to say the end goal would be to replace some of our existing currencies like US dollars? Because when you look at the broader cryptocurrency market, you have Bitcoin, you have Ethereum, you have, mm-hmm. You know, Tezos, and so many varieties of it. And they're highly volatile. So as a medium of exchange, it becomes really hard to use them for day-to-day purposes. So how does this become more practical?
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, it has a very high practicality in the first place. So as you rightfully asked, why would we need it? Yeah, so we have already a monetary system, we have currencies, the world is running on them today. But We need to disintermediate, eliminate this central control. And we also need to, even if we don't disintermediate, we can actually make the system much more productive, much less expensive. So we can streamline the financial systems and how the transactions are done today. While I am not sure if all cryptocurrencies are well positioned to fulfill that, it all depends how we, of course, how would I say, design them. Yes, and most cryptocurrencies today are used, you know, as a means to make money by the traders. So I think that was not the initial purpose. I think the main purpose is still to be realized. Right. And there are particular designs of cryptocurrencies that can address the issue of money and of currencies, following the definition, yes, as money as a bearer instrument for facilitating these transactions between buyer and seller, and systems of exchange done electronically.
What would some of those design? Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yes, of course. So you know, mainly the main idea is, because you mentioned Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then, you know, these are very volatile things. Yes, so right. We do not want to actually transact in them, because we will end up buying a pizza with $1 million at some point, you know.
Exactly.
So we can do it a bit better. And that's where this role of stable coins is, you know, becoming very important. So in the simplest sense, a stable coin is a form of digital currency that provides price stability via backing by a reserve asset. And these reserve assets can be either a fiat currency or, well, in case of Libra, a basket of fiat currencies, or a commodity like the petrol, a barrel of oil. So, such designs are much more suitable, you know, to be used to buy a pizza than Bitcoin.
Right, because I don't want to give one Bitcoin away and next day I know its price has gone to 100,000 or it has gone to $100. So it's hard.
Definitely.
To measure what I'm exactly paying for. So you mentioned stable coins and you mentioned a few, right? One is pegging against, say, a US dollar or being a basket of currencies or Libra and so on and so forth. Do you think this is where the future of money is moving towards, a stable coin? The design you mentioned, which is the stable coin, is that the future of money?
You know, I'm a great fan of the late Bernard Littaire, who actually was the brain behind the design of the euro, but they did not implement the euro how he suggested, unfortunately. And he was also the general manager of Bank in Europe. So he had positions of leadership, and he wrote this book, The Future of Money. Actually, I had the privilege to work with Bernard and on many projects, but the last one before he passed was this book, From Bitcoin to Burning Man and Beyond, The Quest for Sovereignty in the Digital Society. And so in his book, The Future of Money, Bernard was looking at the monetary system, and he proposed that we can actually implement it more flexible, more like an ecosystem, and more community-oriented, more like, you know, the tribes are using the monetary system. There are many tribes, and then they find a way to exchange among each other the goods. And so he envisioned that now that we have cryptocurrencies, we can actually, by pegging them to stable values, we can create this ecosystem of various values and to embed the rules of the game. And the game is different from community to community, from tribe to tribe. So to embed those rules in the money, which is now possible, and we call it programmable money. But you know, your question is very big. What is the future of money? And right. But I think, as it relates to cryptocurrencies, Bernard Litter's, if you read his book, you will definitely see it. And he was also an advisor to Bancor, which is enabling this kind of exchange from cryptocurrency to cryptocurrency quite seamlessly. So he was hoping that we will get there sooner now because we have the cryptocurrencies that can enable this ecosystem, financial ecosystem.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. No, I think the future of finance, as you pointed out correctly, is a much broader question. But to provide more context, so the concept of digital money or e-cash has been there for a while. I think it was David Chaum back in the 1990s who came up with the idea of e-cash, but then, then credit cards and cards online became so much more popular that it essentially had to kill the idea. So the question then becomes, what does digital money become? Because from a common consumer's point of view, I am already transacting online using my credit card or debit card. I'm not holding any cash, and I'm transacting in US dollars to purchase anything that I want to, say in the US, right? Why do I need a stable coin? What additional value would, say, a stable coin, a basket of currencies would provide that I'm currently not getting through my existing credit card or the ACS transfers or so forth?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, when it comes to cryptocurrencies, of course, stable coins are reducing volatility. But when it comes to implementing, let's say, a fiat currency, the dollar, yes, and there are several stable coins that are implementing that. Of course, stable coins are providing the same benefits that Bitcoin provides, but with stability, backed by stability. So they provide this direct, the possibility to have the direct transaction. And it all depends how you design them. So if you allow me to elaborate a bit here, because the question,
yes,
you know, this is not as straightforward because there are so many kinds of stable coins. So there are those stable coins which central banks are eyeing, if I am to if I am to refer to that like this.
Right.
So, you know, there's this central bank digital currencies,
right,
which, yes, they are practically positioned, although nobody has done it yet, mm-hmm, to release their fiat currencies in digital forms. And those would be stable coins, because the only way to do it is using the crypto encryption. So they would be cryptocurrencies, but stable coins in this regard. But there is a difference, yes. So there are stable coins which can be released by other, by private companies, for example, not by central banks. So the stable coin ecosystem is a bit larger than the central bank issued currencies. And therefore, yes, you pay with Visa. If your central bank is issuing the digital dollar, let's say, or, you know, the Chinese currency on a blockchain, then you can, of course, streamline that. So what you can have, then you have the speed, the cost and accessibility improvements offered by cryptocurrencies now in your financial infrastructure relative to the traditional bank accounts, which are those dinosaurs which consume, as I was mentioning, very costly. But there are other types of stable coins, which and I can address that. So they mainly address the issues of these archaic banking systems via their open access designs, mm-hmm, enabling consumers all over the world to store, send, and receive fiat currencies at no cost with only a smartphone and an internet connection. So the problem is, first of all, that we do not have those kind of stable coins. I mean, we do not have a central bank release currency yet. Digital currency. So therefore, how I would call these ones, these are like, you know, intermediate solutions, a sort of offshoots that, you know, they are hybrids between central bank and a private corporation, which are issuing various kinds of forms of money or intermediate forms of this money. And for example, you know, the sovereign in the Marshall Islands, they have been approved by the government, but it's actually a foundation which is issuing the money, and the technology behind it is a private company. So these are called synthetic CBDCs, if you allow me. But they are tokens denominated in national currencies, but issued by a private sector firm in partnership with this central bank and this financial institution. They have many properties because you can design those properties now with the blockchain.
I think I agree. And then stablecoins, as you pointed out, yeah, it provides stability against the light of a ton of other cryptocurrencies that are highly volatile. So it's much more favorable. If anything was to replace, say, a medium of exchange, it would probably be a stable currency in a digital format, a cryptocurrency in that sense. And the CBDC is an interesting design, as you rightly pointed out as well, is being explored by the central banks. From the monetary system point of view, how would implementing a CBDC change the state of affairs as it currently stands, right? Because there are two sides to central bank issued currencies, like the banknotes. There's a wholesale side and there's a retail side. What would it take to kind of implement a central bank issued digital currency and its adoption, say, from retail side of things?
Well, you know, so this comes back to history again, yes,
right.
Now, who is issuing the money, right? Mm-hmm. And most of us still believe that the money should be issued by the central bank. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of us who are Bitcoin lovers don't think that. And so, you know, so again, many stable coins are solving also this conundrum, but most money is actually produced or released by commercial banks. I don't know if you are, and your listeners are aware of that. So you know, this is a very complex problem, and it's not going to be easily solved as long as you know, we still have the same systems in place. But what I can offer to you, which can probably give hope to your listeners, and also, if I may express here my own personal preference.
Please do,
So I would really love to have money issued by just very similar to the MakerDAO. I don't know if you know this stablecoin DAI. By an autonomous organization in which I have, you know, the rules embedded in software, in math, we trust, and we have the algorithms actually evaluating when to release and how much to release and how to keep everything stable. In the case of MakerDAO, this is done by so-called over-collateralization across several cryptocurrencies, and it's quite complex, but you cannot escape that in today's world. But there are other models of stable coins, like for example BASIS, BASIS, which is an excellent, in my opinion, an excellent solution, because what they do, they actually algorithmically calculate dynamically calculate the market situation, and then how much money should they release or how many coins should they burn in order to keep the stability of the money. So this is done by math, by the algorithm in which we trust. And as a scientist, definitely, I trust that much more than, you know, the printing machine over which centralized governments have power these days. Which have gotten us in a lot of trouble before, and now we see it before our eyes how our money is going to be devalued, and it is actually being devalued through all these trillions of dollars printed overnight.
You mentioned the basis coin, right?
Yes.
And being the algorithmically run stable coin, but wasn't it like shut down a couple of years ago because it was not able to meet certain securities regulator standards? Does that bring a ton of challenges to these private stablecoin enterprises who are trying to use algorithm and mathematics to essentially kind of print and supply money and make either inflationary or deflationary economic standards based on just algorithm?
Well, right. Of course. There is regulation in the algorithm. The algorithm is a rule, actually, which implements a certain monetary, like monetary issuance. Yes, how do I, when do I take money out from the system, or when do I release the money so I keep stability over the money? Yeah. I do not know what were they looking at. Of course, maybe they were looking at KYC and, you know, AML and all the other stuff, and that's a different conversation. I was answering your question with regard to how can we actually implement a monetary system that works. And so, you know, so there's, and I was giving you this example, so it's my favorite implementations. Yeah. That doesn't mean that the system today is ready to accept them. However, I think these other ones, which are like even Tether, who, I mean, we know that they have so many problems with the regulators, but this is the most used stable coin today. So, you know, I don't want to say who cares about the regulator. I just want to say that the regulators are coming from that system, which we are dislocating now, that dysfunctional monetary and financial system, which this new implementations and new forms of money are dislocating. And of course we have then the true US dollars, the USDC, the versions of the stable coins pegged to the US dollar.
Right.
But the problem with them, like also with the petro, is that they are centralized. Yes, they are issued by a centralized entity. Mm-hmm. And the oversight is done by a centralized entity as well. So the thing is that, yes, they are as stable as the dollar is. We will see what's going to happen. Yes.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is that the other ones, the ones which the digital, the algorithms are managing and actually releasing, they are decentralized. That is a very big difference. So,
got it.
So
yeah.
especially for me, with a backstory which is about freedom from the centralized systems, you can imagine there's no discussion what I would embrace.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think we are moving. I think the challenge happens because we're moving from a centralized state or systems to, and talking about completely decentralized system. And I think there's going to be some sort of a hybrid play in between, where certain aspects of that decentralized world is still centralized, whether it be from a governance aspect or onboarding and so on and so forth. But that kind of brings me also to the next question, which is, you know, in the past we'd had communication, which used to be face to face or like in person. And with the advent of internet and the digital channels being open, that has become much more virtual. That has obviously taken away the privacy aspect from an individual. And we are starting to talk about similar aspects, say in terms of stable coins or CBDC, you know, where there's a massive decline in cash transactions. Because what's the biggest advantage of cash? Please be, you know, if you disagree with the comment, is it provides you that privacy, that anonymity to go with. With everything moving digital, and especially with the point that you brought up with CBDC, how does that privacy aspects or anonymity aspect can be still be preserved? Or that is something we should be okay to give up in the future?
Yeah, no, of course, and the balancing of the privacy and then the, of course, accountability for how we spend the money, of course, and for fraud, eventual potential of fraud. This is, I think, an equal challenge. Is it as big a challenge as the data conundrum was before the blockchain appeared? Because initially, yeah, you had the centralized platforms, and then, okay, so how do you balance the privacy of the individual versus benefiting from that data, which is so important, for example, by using by the used by the CDC these days to tell us, okay, well, it's okay to open a region or not, you know, so, and they need our data for that. Okay, so now, of course, there are ways on blockchain to do both. So first of all, and I'm referring also to my work with the sovereign, the Marshall Islands currency, they call themselves a blockchain with identity. But the thing is that they don't and won't ever monitor, you know, if I am going to the grocery to buy milk for my children. That, however, they have flagging system that, you know, if there are certain dubious transactions that are happening, then they are flagged, and then there is a possibility to go into the system and track what is happening. But this is only if necessary and if it's flagged. So there are ways to, we don't have to give up our privacy. There are ways to implement that. The thing is, of course, when it comes to the sovereign, yes, this is done by a foundation, and the foundation directors are luminaries. I mean, people who have very high credibility, and so they are actually monitoring that and how this oversight, if I may call it this way, is implemented, just to be sure that it's done in a democratic way, which respects the rights of the individual. So, so yeah, no, we do not have to give up our privacy, not at all. But of course, I would gladly adhere to such a system, and I, you know, I would trust as much as possible. Obviously, these luminaries, I mean, I trust algorithms a bit more than humans. So, you know, in artificial intelligence, we trust. I do not know about people. They can change. But until we are able to design those algorithms that can provide that oversight, I will trust the luminaries, which are overseeing how the foundation that is releasing and managing the monetary system is running.
Got it. I think there's obviously the design aspect matters quite a bit, how you ensure that all the loopholes and the risk criterion have been placed into designing a stable coin or central bank digital currencies. But also now we also have this private enterprise and a central bank and sort of hybrids that are coming to work together to create a stable coin. From an adoption perspective, what do you think is that inflection point, or why we haven't seen as much of an adoption of stable coins or more broadly cryptocurrencies in general?
Well, of course, it is inertia, yes. I mean, in the first place, yes, so we are all familiar with the paper money and then slowly with our credit cards, and we are giving up the paper gradually. However, you know, I don't know how you measure this adoption, but the young generation, definitely they are set to adopt very quickly. Mm-hmm. The thing is that we do not have those money yet. Yeah, I mean, we are here at the cusp and a transition point between the old and the new system. And we have these intermediaries now, and we have, for example, the sovereign, which is positioned to actually fulfill that role and create digital money, fiat money, around the world for everyone. The digital dollar was now accelerated on one side by the fact that China is, you know, releasing their digital currency, and on the other side by the need to make quick payments in the wake of the COVID-19 economic crisis. Right. So the Congress is considering it, and it's, you know, yeah, probably it will be released very soon. Once it's released, obviously it will be adopted. But the question is this the best thing? So then again, yes, and there are many others like Libra, yes, and is that the best thing? There are a few solutions which are very different from each other. So for example, the Marshall Islands, we have the offers, the sovereign, not the market. So, for example, the sovereign is offering ways to implement the currency to adapt it to the needs of a particular country, because we can practically deploy the money and program them to embed the values of the particular people. As I was mentioning with what Bernard Litter was forecasting for the future of money. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Marshall Islands, for example, they have this time-released monetary issuance. So every year, they are implementing the Milton Friedman X percent rule, in which they are releasing 4% of the money. And from that 4%, there are various percentages which are distributed. For example, a percentage of that money goes in form of a universal basic income. Another percentage goes into a fund for climate change and for health and so on and so forth. So all this is done automatically, yes, algorithmically, being programmed into the money. While the blockchain on which these things are released and the money are released and the rules are running as smart contracts, that is under the foundation oversight. I mentioned to you why, just so we keep that balance between privacy and fraud, possibility for fraud. So, but then there is the Libra and all the other stable coins and so on. So when you say adoption, I think because of all these solutions, and of course Libra does not exist, it's just an intent for
it's
now.
It's a concept, that's another, yes.
It's another conversation altogether. I can tell you a lot about it as well. But the thing is that all these aspects, shapes and forms of stable coins, you know, because there are so many, even if they are adopted, you would have to go across all of them to see the level of adoption. But there's a wide adoption if you look at how widely and the transactions which are happening. We're using Tether and this other stable fiat-based backed stable currencies. There are a lot of transactions going on.
Right. I think the question was more around the ubiquity of it, like how we use US dollars for our day-to-day transactions, right? I don't go around using Tether or MakerDAO or any of these stable currencies to pay for my rent or pay for my utility bill or buy groceries. So that's where I was going with the adoption aspect. But I totally see your point that, you know, it would vary. There's still a lot of transactions that are happening using these currencies, and it will obviously take a time because technically we are not there. So totally understand that. So one thing that around stable coins, there was a report that came out from FSB where they were like, they recommend against the usage of stable coins. I'm not sure if you are aware of that.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I can understand that. I can understand that also from the perspective of Libra and what danger it poses. And it can be summed up very simple. Regulators are extremely concerned with the potential that such a stable coin can interfere with monetary sovereignty. That's clear, right? I mean, you can have the Libra Foundation oversee, just as a sovereign foundation oversees how the money is issued and so on and so forth. But you still have a centralized way of dealing with that. And I think they are rightfully, being very cautious in enabling such mechanisms, obviously, because they can become dictatorial mechanisms, they can become instruments for a lot of bad stuff as well as for good stuff, if they are not designed properly. Maybe you read about the Petro and how it's used and right. so on and so forth. So that's a good example. And I think all this reluctance of the FSB is very justified in light right. of such instances and, yep. And the potential, yes, to interfere with this sovereignty.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, if you have the rogue nations that end up designing their own, stable currencies to bypass a lot of these sanctions, it can become very hairy to identify or impose sanctions or other, curb down the criminal activity that kind of comes and goes from some of these rogue nation states. But without dwelling further into that, I know you mentioned about the Facebook Libra project, and it's still very much in its concept phase. Quick thoughts on that, please.
Yes, no, that is a conundrum by itself, I can say, and it's so much fun. And I remember that when first I heard about it, my first thought was, and I think I've been immortalized on a panel with that, because they were asking, what do you think? I'm like, over my dead body. that was my first reaction. And I will explain to you why. So the point was that, everything depends. I mean, we had to trust those who can actually afford $10 million to put into that thing to be the validators. And actually all the validators in the Libra network will need to be vetted and given permission by the Libra Association. So that was for me, a no from the start. And since then, how it was initially designed, yes, the original vision was for Libra to be a stable coin backed by all this reserve of cash and low-risk government securities, denominated by, in all this basket of selected fiat currencies. The thing was not necessarily that, which is fine, yes. The thing was, how are you actually managing the money? And who is deciding that the transaction happened or not? And why would I trust? I don't have, anything right now, because it's an association, right? But these are still in this association. There are those organizations which we don't necessarily trust, and which the Bitcoin revolutionaries wanted to dislocate. So, but it has changed since then, because obviously not only I said over my dead body, but others as well. Right. So that didn't go. How it has changed, it's becoming, I think, a little bit more doable, I would say, because now it will still be a coin, but it will be this digital composite of this single currency stable coins available on the network. So we would have the dollar, Libra, back to the dollar, back to the Japanese yen, back to the euro, and so on and so forth. So they are redesigning the whole concept so it can be easier managed, I think, because now if you have one-to-one peg to the dollar, obviously, yes, so you know how the dollar runs, and they they can be trusted at least as much as I trust anyone who is releasing US dollars, if I do trust them at all. But the regulators, at least they would accept it more, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The point is that definitely, if we are thinking about CBDC and this digital version of money, Libra definitely can help accelerate this now, especially because this new approach in which they are pegging it to different money, for example, when I release the digital dollar, then they can embrace it immediately. I mean, for now, yeah, it's their version of the dollar, but when the digital dollar is released, it will become part, I mean, Libra will actually run on that infrastructure, and they are open to do that. So this is definitely, yes, they cannot accelerate, can help accelerate the adoption enormously, yeah, because of the outreach, which, speaking of adoption, I think that is the main benefit that, that Libra can bring to this, to the monetary ecosystem, if I am to call it this way.
I think that's totally valid, right? Because the reach that they have with over, 1.5 billion people that access their platforms, but there are obviously a lot of moving parts, whether it be having the digital US dollar being printed and then Libra actually being delivering on its promise. One thing that you brought up, which I found interesting, was around the trust issue, right? Finance or the monetary system is so trust-based. One of the things that's kind of probably eroded for Facebook, without bashing much on it, is the trust layer that exists, right? And that also ties interestingly with the algorithmic trading. So from when I'm thinking as an end consumer and I'm someone comes and tells me that, hey, your money is being managed or being printed or governed by some algorithm in the back end. Like, how do I establish trust? Because right now I know I can count on the government or some central authority to like back me up. Who am I dependent here if anything goes wrong?
Yeah, no, but I think we have to make this distinction, which is very clear, between trading algorithms and an algorithm which is actually managing the monetary supply. So that algorithm which is managing the monetary supply is looking for the stability of that money. So not necessarily for infinite growth of your portfolio. So these are two very different things, and it's much easier, you know, to actually interpolate over the markets and determine the stability of your monetary supply and encapsulate that as an algorithm versus to anticipate what the crazy markets will do. So these are two very different problems, although they are both algorithmic. Yes, I definitely can say that I trust the monetary supply algorithm, obviously, but the other ones, you know, it does not depend on the algorithm. It depends on the craze of the markets. I mean, how would my algorithm anticipate COVID-19 and all this economic downfall? I mean, it's impossible, right? So although I can, of course, attune, and of course there are ways, I don't know how legal they are to actually do that, but I'm not in that business, and this is not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about money and digital currencies and how to do that algorithmically.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I think the supply demand question. So essentially what you're pointing towards is the monetary policy aspect, the supply and demand of currency, what the central bank or the Fed's role currently is, right? Shouldn't be able to just print $4 trillion out of thin air. There should be reasons to do so.
Exactly.
Very well. Yeah. Dr. Mihaela, so what are you most excited about, within the space, and why?
No, absolutely. And, you know, we come back to the original question and my background. So I see digital money or programmable money, which is actually what excites me most, a means to implement seamless governance systems that enable, you know, things like automatic taxation, insurance payments, they enable adjustments for people who really need, for example, you know, they lost their job and that, and immediately an adaptive way of governing the monetary system, the financial system, which is impossible to do without digital money, without programmable money. So that is, I'm very excited about this possibility. And of course, if we are taking it to whatever, I think you would see that as the extreme, although for me it's not, it's a dream.
Right.
This, the DAO, which flexibly can apply these rules and adapt the financial system to compensate much smoother for eventual crashes and unexpected events like COVID-19 and so on and so forth. I definitely trust the DAOs much more than I currently trust the US Congress deciding on releasing all this money and then printing them for quick fixes. But that is a different conversation altogether. So that's what excites me, the potential that digital currencies are bringing in this regard.
Right. I think it'll chip away at the system slowly but steadily. And as the technology continues to progress, and we keep forgetting that it's only been 12 years that we are actually being exposed to the system overall, and we're trying to fight against centuries old monetary system that currently stands. I'm sure it'll take fighting from all different angles to bring it to the 21st century.
Exactly. Well. And thank you for that, because, in light of what you just said, mm-hmm. your question about adoption was a bit mm-hmm. unfair. So you're like, of course.
That's on me.
We are doing our best here, and I think that we, even at the adoption level, we're doing pretty well. And all these crises are only accelerating the adoption. Because
right.
people become more and more aware of the fallacies of the current system. So they are looking for alternatives.
Right. No, absolutely. One other question that I have for you, Doctor, is what's a startup or a company that you think is doing things the right way within the crypto sphere? And what are the things that you think they're doing right?
There are so many. I mean, there are so many, and in so many areas. So I it would be so unfair to pick one. But I can tell you that, if you talk about money and mm-hmm. money issuance, or are you talking in general in the crypto space?
It's related to money, yeah. That's just...
Yes, because, obviously, and here, I think I'm biased, but I do not know any others which are doing that. So these mm-hmm. are pioneers. And again, if you go to sov.global, I hope you will get convinced as well. So the sovereign is pioneering the issuance of digital currency, of digital fiat money, I think definitely in the right way. So if we're talking programmable money, look no further than the sovereign. Right. SOV.global.
SOV.global.
Yes, that's a short for sovereign. And of course, the money is called SOVIS.
Got it. Okay. And what are some things that you believe they're approaching it the right way?
Yes, no, of course. And so this is the inflation avoidance. So they released this Milton Friedman 4% money supply every year. Then programming how the money is being distributed. So this is to embed a universal basic income into the money issuance. Yes, so you have that. So you distribute a portion of the money to every individual in that country. So, and then you distribute automatically as well to the funds which are taking care of the very existence of the country. For example, the Marshall Islands, they are going to go underwater first with the climate change. So therefore, for them, climate, then fishing and all these kind of their main businesses, yes, and fishing and so on and so forth. So embedding the values of the nation in their currency. What mm-hmm. more can you wish for?
Right.
And they are implementing correctly exactly the concern which you raised, the mm-hmm. privacy versus the detection of fraud. And so it's yeah, it's wonderful. And again, a foundation is has oversight, and this foundation led by luminaries who are very highly respected and we trust.
Very well. Yep. No, very well. So SOV.global, definitely check them out. I don't know, we are running out of time here. One last question. How can anyone listening to this podcast contact you or get in touch with you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You can find me very easily on LinkedIn. My name, I think it will be when you release the podcast, you just put it in LinkedIn and find me. I respond. I like that. The best way to contact me is that. If you go to, in one word, theimpactinstitute.org, that is where I have the repository of all my over 300 publications and my academic work, as well as keynotes and talks. And you can find my contact information there as well, theimpactinstitute.org.
Brilliant. I'll have all that information in my notes as well. And thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Dr. Mihaela. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. No, that was very exciting. And yes, so your questions were very insightful and made me aware of things which I didn't think of before. So thank you for pushing me to the edge a bit here.
I'm glad. Yes, thank you. I really enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Mihaela. There's so much to learn, so much still to be explored within the cryptocurrency and blockchain sphere. And I hope each one of you listening to this episode got something out of this. I'm sure I did, but this is the end for our episode today. So until next week, namaste.